The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 183.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi guys, welcome to today's live stream. It is Sunday. I am right here in the temporary office in Phoenix, Arizona. Good to see everyone. Before we dive in, I want to remind you that I started a new YouTube channel. It is called Rebel Capitalist. Imagine that. That's the name of the YouTube channel. And I don't even know if it's like being picked up right now by YouTube. So let me try to go over here and get the link for you guys, and I'll put it in the chat. But basically what it's all about is I'm just going on there like two or three times a day, Monday through Friday, and just whatever news articles that I find that are interesting and I think relevant to kind of our worldview, at least kind of that libertarian Austrian type of worldview, you know, with the central banks, the big governments, and kind of the skepticism of what's going on right now. I just post it there, and I kind of give my commentary on the article. So I'll bring it up on the screen share and then just talk about it and why I think it's relevant to your financial future and your future from a standpoint of personal liberty and freedom. So if you want that type of content, and it's unedited, I just hit the record button. As soon as I get done, about 10 minutes later, I turn it off and boom, I upload it. So, okay. So I just put the URL in the chat, guys. And it looks like it's in Facebook as well. So if you want to check that out after the live stream, head over, hit the subscribe button, and you will see me two or three times starting tomorrow. All right, cool. So let's dive into the questions. What do we have today? Okay, Kelton. Oh boy, we're gonna start the day with Stephanie Kelton, huh? Says the debt is simply a record of money left in the system from the beginning and causes no problems. The debt is simply a record of the money left in the system. Oh, right, right, right. Says government deficit always creates consumer surplus. Your thought? I don't know, man. Listen. the MMT people like Kelton and Mosler, they're very smart people for sure. And I would argue they understand the system probably better than a lot of the mainstream economists out there. But what they do is they just have this way of spinning things to make you like, what? Oh, they're right. Oh, yeah, of course, it's true. The government deficit is a consumer surplus. Well, yeah, so the bigger the government deficit, then the richer we are. Like, oh, of course. But then they don't tell you that, okay, well, it's not just a consumer surplus. And by the way, it might not be consumer surplus. It just means that there's increased M2 money supply. That assumes that pieces of paper, this one's a yellow piece of paper, but whether it's yellow or green and has dead presidents on it, it doesn't matter. She assumes that that consumer surplus is wealth. It's not wealth. The only thing that's wealth is the amount of goods and services that our society produces efficiently. So we have a consumer surplus of green pieces of paper. Fantastic. That doesn't make us any better off. What makes us better off, again, is our ability to produce stuff in and if by the government running those huge deficits. It distorts the economy. It misallocates resources, and it creates malinvestment, then it's creating a society that fundamentally, over the long run, is going to be able to produce less and less, and therefore will become poorer and poorer and poorer. So however she wants to spin it and make it sound clever, fine. but that's all it is clever spin. And it's like Keynesian economics. It looks good in a textbook, but then you put it to practice in real life and it doesn't work too well. Question, let's play devil's advocate. Hasn't money printing developed our world and reduction? No. Okay, so, it depends on how you define money printing. The expansion of the money supply for productive lending, yeah. So if you look at the euro dollar system that Snyder talks about all the time, prior to it completely breaking in 2008, the function, among many other things, but the main function initially, you know, when it was kind of formed as a result of a solution to Bretton Woods turning the dollar into the world reserve currency, therefore the currency which the business of the world would operate, and the problem being there's not enough dollars outside of the United States to facilitate global growth or to maximize on global growth. So what do? You have commercial banks that just create their own dollar denominated loans. So that is increasing the money supply. If you want to call that money printing, okay, then we can call that money printing. But if that increase in the money supply by the commercial banking system, whether it's domestically or foreign, is going to create more goods and services, if it's going to create more productivity, then I would argue that increasing the money supply is a good thing. And it definitely has reduced poverty in the developed worlds. Totally agree. But the type of money printing that we're doing right now, where it has nothing to do with creating more goods and services, it has nothing to do with increasing productivity. In fact, it's doing the complete opposite. Then that type of money printing has not reduced poverty. And that type of money printing will increase poverty in the developed countries. So it'll do just the opposite. Instead of reducing poverty in developing countries, it will increase poverty in developed countries instead of the last three decades, over the next three decades. So you see, all lending and all money printing or all creation of additional currency units are not created equal. It all depends on what you're using the increase in the money supply for. That's why Snyder always says, in a perfect world, I know we don't live in one, but in a perfect world, the money supply would be able to expand with demand for productive loans. You see, that's kind of the ideal. But lending to countries or entities or consumers just to consume, then that's how you get poorer. Okay, RS investment in another country. RS, can you share what you look for? RS, maybe real estate? Is that maybe what you're saying here? Real estate investing or investment in another country? Can you share what you look for? Lessons learned on finding property management agency. How would you do that if you decide to invest in Abu Dhabi? I don't know if I'm looking in Abu Dhabi right now. More Dubai. It's the same. It's just you look at the numbers, you look at the RV ratios, you try to go back and look at the historic prices adjusted for inflation. But it really starts with your cash flow and kind of reverse engineering it from there. And then if you've got a good macro theme, that's even better. Like Dubai, in my opinion, has a really strong macro theme. Then as far as, so that's regardless of what country I'm looking at, that's first thing. You're just looking at the numbers. You're looking at the cash flow. You're looking at the prices adjusted for inflation, the price to income ratios, same stuff I'd look for here in the United States. As far as property management companies, that's your biggest problem. That's because See, here's the issue with property management. It's a terrible business. If you think about their business model and you actually just do the math, you come to the conclusion that if they're charging 8 to 10% of the gross rents received, then they're only bringing in enough money to cover their expenses. So the only way that they can actually make profit is if they rip you off. And I'm not saying that all property management companies are bad guys or have malicious intent or don't have or aren't ethical. I just don't think when they go into starting a property management company, I honestly don't think they really work through the numbers. Like, they don't sit down to think about what they're doing, because most property managers that I've met in my life that have property management companies, that was their first business. And they kind of build the monster. And then 2 or 3 years later, after they've got 1,000 properties or 500 properties under management, they look around and be like, oh my gosh, I just created a ball and chain. I just dug myself a hole that I can't really get out of, and I'm screwed. I got problems here. So that's why whenever I look for a property management company, I always want to go into their office, and I don't ask normal questions. I ask questions like, oh, do you own the building here, or are you just leasing this 5,000 square feet? Oh, you're leasing. Oh, okay. So then on my little pad, I just write down monthly rent, $5,000. Like, oh, well, how many employees do you have? Oh, we've got 15. Okay, great. 15 employees, average annual salary, let's say 30, 35 grand. You can just reverse engineer it to figure out how much their monthly nut is for payroll and their office lease. And then, you throw on another however many percent for miscellaneous and everything else that you've got in it. And then you just say, okay, well, how many properties are you managing? Oh, we're managing 500. Okay, fantastic. Where are they? Oh, well, they're in these areas. And you just think in your back of your mind, okay, well, it's about, on average, probably about $1,500 a month in rent or $1,200 a month in rent, whatever. And then you're like, okay, then how much are you guys charging? Oh, we're only charging 8% management fee. So like, okay, well, their monthly nut is 40 grand. I'm just throwing these numbers out there. Their monthly nut is 40 grand. They're managing 500 properties. And at 8% of the gross, assuming that their average rent is about 1,500 bucks, let's say they're only bringing in 35 grand. So you're like, okay, well, that's a $5,000 deficit per month. So where is the extra $5,000 going to come from? Ding, ding, ding. It comes from maintenance fees. So they are incentivized to create maintenance that doesn't exist. And they're incentivized to wildly overcharge you. So your hot water heater breaks down. And if you had someone install it yourself and get one from Home Depot, you're looking at, let's say, $1,000. But now all of a sudden, your property management says, oh, you got to do it. You got to do it quick. The renter's complaining and they don't have any hot water, blah, 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 blah. And you're like, oh, yeah, fix it fast. Just any price. How much is it? Oh, it's $2,500, but we got you a deal. Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, you just overpaid by $1,500. You see? So my point is, if you go in there and figure out their business model really quick, which is easy to do. I just walked you guys through it here in 5 minutes or whatever. And then you can tell if they're actually making profit by doing things that aren't screwing you over. So your incentives are aligned. What you'll find with most property management companies is your incentives and their incentives are completely the opposite. So that's why most often when I'm selecting a property management company, I actually choose the one that has the highest fees. as far as charging me, as far as what they take out of my monthly rent, because I know they're profitable just on that. And they don't have to screw me over on the back end just to survive, right? So that's, I think, the best advice I can give you on property management companies. And then just keep in mind, I mean, you're going to have to kiss a lot of frogs. You just are. And that's why when I've been looking at Dubai, it's even more interesting because they have so many huge residential buildings where you could go in and you could buy a lot of inventory for, you know, you could drop 20 million in like one building. That's pretty good because you can get a lot of units. And then the more you can consolidate those units, the more you can consolidate the property management, the easier your life is going to be. And that's why, if you guys watch my interview with Ken McElroy, my good buddy who does all of Robert Kiyosaki's real estate investing, you know, that's where they've just made a ton of money, is in multifamily, because they'll buy an apartment complex that has, you know, whatever, 200, 300, 500 doors, and they can consolidate that property management and make it far more efficient. And instead of turning it into, instead of it being a negative, they actually turn it into a positive and therefore an edge. Is it time to put a higher priority on purchasing a second passport in regards to percentage of assets that you have available to spend to get one? Yeah, I mean, that's the big question, Eric. If you're spending 100% of your net worth to buy a passport, then I don't think that makes much sense. But if it's 1%, then I think, yeah, it definitely makes a lot of sense. Yeah. The last part is with what looks like a free speech shutdown. What I want people to take away from this question is, so hopefully I answered your question, Eric, but a lot of people always come to me and they, you know, with as much traveling as I do, and I encourage Americans to have a plan B. I'm not saying just leave the United States, but have a plan B. They always say to me, well, I never want to do that because there's no place, or very few places have freedom of speech like we have here in the United States. I'm like, okay, but you have to differentiate between the laws that are on the books and the reality of the laws, or the reality of how, let's use freedom of speech as an example, is actually applied in the real world, in the society. So I would argue, as an example, that in practice, we have less free speech in the United States than you would in another country that might not have it as a part of their constitution, but where free, just everyone kind of speaks freely and it's no big deal. I think of Colombia to a certain degree. So in Colombia, you're not going to get fired from your corporate job by going on Twitter and claiming that there are only two sexes. There's just male and female. I know it sounds an outrageous claim, I know, but you're not going to get fired for that. Where in the United States, I don't know, you might. So in practice, where is there actual freedom of speech? That's what you have to ask yourself. And I think, again, I'm an American, and I think the Constitution is one of the most amazing things that has ever been created. But unfortunately, just looking at it through the lens of being realistic, you have to say, okay, yeah, that's technically you have the right to free speech, but in practice, you know, you're not going to be thrown in jail for saying something, but they're just going to destroy your life. So do we really have freedom of speech? And do we have more or less than country XYZ that isn't so obsessed with this PC culture, but yet that law might not be a part of their constitution? And I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying these are things that I think people and Americans need to think through. And I don't think many people do. Tether, what are my thoughts? I don't know. I listened to Schiff's podcast the other day. He made some good counterpoints. I haven't looked into it enough to tell you whether I think it's a Ponzi scheme or not, but I probably wouldn't buy into it myself. I just prefer the physical gold. Yeah, why can't crypto? I mean, let's throw Bitcoin in there. So why can't Bitcoin? Why can't the government crush Bitcoin with regulation and taxation? The trading platforms are becoming more Orwellian with the know your customer rules. Well, that's sure true. That with the NY or the KYC or whatever they call it. Bitcoiners make a great point in that the government really can't destroy Bitcoin. It's decentralized. It's like an electronic cockroach. You can't, and I'm saying that in a good way, you can't just destroy it. But what they can do is they can say owning it, if you get caught owning it, it's 50 years in prison. And the Bitcoiners would say, well, how are they going to find out if you own it? And there's no way to do that. And I get it. I totally get it. And if the United States does that, then all the people that own Bitcoin are just going to immediately leave the United States and they're going to go somewhere else in a jurisdiction where it's not illegal. And listen, I get the argument. I totally get it. But I'm not sure how many Americans with a wife or a husband and kids in private school and a member of their local country club and got all their friends and family and their grandparents around, and they've got this, they're kind of like a vegetable, right? They've got these roots. I don't know how many of those people are going to be like, what? The government made transacting in Bitcoin illegal? I'm out of here. Honey, grab the kids. We're going to Saudi Arabia. You see? So, I mean, that's kind of how I think it through. And my point is, I don't know the government can crush Bitcoin as an example. They can just say transacting in it is going to put you in prison for a long, long time. Now, I had that discussion with Raoul Paul, who obviously I have a tremendous amount of respect for. And he brings up a great point. He says, George, it's very unlikely because now so many of these funds and pools of money, pension funds, whatever, are buying into Bitcoin. It's a lot less likely for governments to come in and make it illegal. And I totally respect that view. But if it starts to compete with, I think, that's really the thing. If it just remains a digital store of value, then I don't know that the governments really mess with it too much. But if it starts to become a preferred means of transacting, then I don't know how the governments are going to look at that. And then to your point, they can kind of they do have a bit of power over the. What they call them, the on ramps and the off ramps, and we'll see how it plays out. I think you've just got to look at it as a network, and how strong will that network effect be compared to the network effect of the dollar and the digital dollar once, or the Fed coin once the Fed has their own digital currency. And then how will that play with the network of the digital yuan, which will be the digital currency, or is already the digital currency for the PBOC, People's Bank of China. So I think that's kind of the way you have to look at the probabilities, and that's kind of how I see it. And I don't know that I see it. Well, I shouldn't say that. I was going to say that's how I see it playing out, but I don't know that that's how I see it playing out. That's just the potential scenarios that I try to handicap in my own mind to figure out the probabilities of Bitcoin becoming global money or just remaining a digital store of value. And if so, what does that do to the price long term, right?
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Can you try to put in layman's terms how zero or negative interest rate bonds are used as capital? As capital. Well, I'm not sure if your question mark is capital or capital gains. So as capital, I mean, you can lever them. I mean, you can borrow against them. Or you can use them as, if you're a JP Morgan or a Goldman Sachs, I mean, you can use them in the repo market. You can use them for, to back up derivatives. There's rehypothecation. I mean, you can go down that rabbit hole as far as you want to go, my friend, or you can use those to make a lot of money because they're quote unquote pristine, pristine collateral. I don't know that that's your question. If it's capital gains, then you're just looking at the price of the bond increasing because the interest rate goes further down. So because there's an inverse relationship between the interest rate and the price of the actual bond. So just as an example, let's say you buy a bond for $1,000, but it's yielding -1%. Well, if the yield goes down to -2%, then the price of that bond would go up. It would go up to $1,500, let's say. So then you would have a capital gain of $500, even though you had a 1% negative carry annually, right? So when people like Jim Grant always talk about, well, how on earth or why on earth would anyone buy a bond that's yielding negative for 20 years or whatever, where you're guaranteed to lose money, especially when you consider the real rate of inflation. It's because they're not thinking about about the yield. They're not thinking about the long term. They're just thinking about the fact that the central bank probably has their back. And if they buy it today for $1,000, tomorrow they'll be able to sell it for $1,500. And it's worth the negative carry. It's just like buying a house in where there's a negative carry, but you think the market's really hot. Let's use California as an example. You buy a house, you get a renter in there, and you're still cash flow negative every single month. And someone says, well, why on earth do you do that? You say, because I bought the place for $1 million, but I think in 6 months it's going to be worth $1.5 million. So I'm okay with having to spend $3,000 or $4,000 a month in negative carry with property taxes and maintenance and insurance and whatnot, in my mortgage payment. I'm okay to do that because I'm going to make $500 supposedly over the next
6 months, and they're doing the exact same thing with bonds. When does this nightmare end? Boy, I don't know. It just seems to be getting crazier and crazier. I mean, really. The question that I would ask, instead of when does this nightmare end, I would ask myself, where is the nightmare least bad in the world today? And I think what we're dealing with across the globe is a nightmare, but there's certain degrees of how bad the nightmare is. And so I'd be thinking about where it's going to be more manageable, not just in the next 6 months, but the next 2 or 3 years, something like that. And keep in mind, just trying to be a realist. I'm not trying to be like doom and gloom or anything. A lot of people accuse me of that, but it's really not my angle. I just try to call it like I see it. And if I see something's jacked up, I'm going to say, hey, this is screwed up. And, unfortunately, I see that the economy is being fundamentally flawed. And I see the war on our personal liberties accelerating so quickly that you just got to call it like you see it. That said, I think that, I don't want people to lose sleep over it, but look, I did it on one of my past videos a couple weeks ago, something like that. I did just a little background history back to 2003 to see how many of these, I don't want to get in trouble with YouTube, but how many of these potential cerveza sicknesses, let's call it that, we've had since 2003. And when you include the cerveza sickness, we've had like 10 of them. 10. So in the last, call it, 18 years or whatever, we've had 10 of these things. So let's just assume that continues. So that means that every 2 years, we're going to have another potential scare. And now that the government has set a precedence over how they handle a potential cerveza sickness. And I'm not saying that in 2 years or a year and a half from now, we're going to have another cerveza sickness, but we'll probably have some sort of, swine flu come up, or bird flu, or what H1N1 type thing. And I'm not saying that it's going to be near as bad or anything, but I am saying that the governments now have, we know their standard operating procedure. So in the future, after what we've just been through, I mean, isn't that going to be the default for governments? If they hear of, let's say, swine flu 2.0 or something like that in China, you don't think that California is going to go into lockdown? If they have, and they're going to shut down all the flights from China or something like that, assuming that we've got the cerveza sickness in the rearview mirror. I mean, I don't know. And I hope it doesn't happen, but I think that these lockdowns, they're going to be something that we're going to have to live with. I don't know, maybe for a long, long time, especially in the United States and the developed worlds. Now you go to a place like Tanzania, probably not going to have to deal with them. They're not even dealing with them now. So I'm not saying that's good or bad. It just is what it is. So you get my point, in that I think we've got some things I'm not saying lose sleep over it, but I am saying be cognizant of how the world is changing, right? You don't want to whistle by the graveyard. And so have a plan B. And, if I could not leave the United States, like I've said a million times, the first thing I would do is hit Craigslist, eBay, and I would buy a cheap RV, get a little Shasta, some kind of retro fun, and put it in your driveway. In the interim, I'd Airbnb it, if that's still legal. if you could still do that. But I would Airbnb it, stock it with food. I'd put my 97, you know, diesel crew cab, F-350, hook it up. And if it just gets crazy, I'm out. I'm headed to Montana. I'm headed to the mountains. I'm done. You know, and I'll be just figure out a way to be self-sufficient up there. And I'll just watch it from a distance. That's kind of the backup plan. But I think an even better strategy, or maybe even in addition to that, would be to try to get that second passport or residency visa if you can. So you've just got options there. You've got mobility. There's no downside in it, right? There's no downside to have mobilities to where if you don't like what's happening in your local area, you can check out. You can go to the next state over. You can go up to the mountains, or you can even go to a different country. And so that's how I kind of, you know, I don't know what the nightmare is going to look like in 2 or 3 years. Hopefully there won't be one. Hopefully this will all be behind us and everything that I'm saying is just worrying about nothing, much ado about nothing. That would be fantastic. But if it is, and you have a plan B, so what? There's still no downside in it. So that's what I'd suggest thinking through, is just the probability of what we're seeing now getting worse, and then looking around the globe to try to determine, or even from the standpoint of the states themselves, like how they're handling this, and to just determine where the nightmare, if we continue life as it is right now, which I would consider a nightmare, you know, where it's going to be least bad. Did I have a mentor when I started my entrepreneurial career, or did I do it on my own? No, I didn't. I just made it happen, man. I didn't even really think about it, to be honest with you. I never woke up one day and said, I'm going to be an entrepreneur today. Woo! It wasn't a conscious thought. It was just, I can tell you what happened. I mean, I remember it very well. Is I was on, just got out of college, and I was playing in some golf tournaments. But believe it or not, back in the day, I was playing in some professional golf tournaments. And I didn't know if that's what I wanted to do longer term. I thought it probably was, but I was going to make a decision. I told myself that I was going to make a decision at the end of this summer. And so I was, this tournament was actually in Tustin, California. I remember it was I was still an amateur. So this was the US amateur, the USAM qualifier, right? And I had the best score. So I didn't even stick around to see if I qualified, because after I got done on the 18th hole, I knew that I was done. I needed to do something else. So on the drive home at that time was Las Vegas. And this was, who knows, I can't remember, like 97, 98, something like that. I'm like, well, what am I going to do? I'm like, I don't know. I'm like, you know, all my buddies come to me all the time and borrow my shirts. They always borrow my t-shirts, and they borrow my dress shirts to go out to the nightclubs, you know, to try to chase girls. But they're always coming to me trying to borrow my shirts. So, you know, I just kind of got daydreaming, and I'm like, I don't know, man, maybe I'll just make some of my own shirts, because my buddies are always stealing mine. I got to thinking, well, yeah, if I make my own shirts, then I don't know, I should probably just make a website. And well, if I make a website, I should probably just sell the t-shirts, or I should sell my shirts. And yeah, like, that's what I'm going to do. That was the extent of how much thought I gave to becoming an entrepreneur. And sure enough, when I got back to Vegas, I'm like, okay, I don't have any money. I was dirt poor. So I'm like, well, I need a way to fund this. So I need to get a valet gig. And so I just went to every single casino down on the strip in an old town. And why did I need a valet gig? I wanted a valet gig because I wanted to work graveyard. And I knew that the valet guys would make like $100-$150 a night in tips. And it doesn't sound like a lot now with everyone's stimmy checks. But back then, this was, I don't know, 97, 98, whatever. That was a decent amount of money. So I'm like, okay, I need a valet gig. I need to work graveyard so I can spend my days building up my t-shirt business or my website. You know, I was doing it all on my own. I didn't have anyone to help me. And so that's what I did. I just went to every single casino until I got a gig. And finally, the Golden Nugget hired me. So I was working graveyard at the Golden Nugget from 10 p.m. to 8 a.m. So I was working 4 10-hour shifts. And then what I would do is when I would leave at 8 a.m. after working all night, then I would work on my little t-shirt thing from about 9 a.m. to call it 3 p.m., 4 p.m. And then I'd sleep a couple hours and then I'd go back to work. So that's how it all started. It was never, oh, I want to be an entrepreneur. What book do I read? How do I do it? It was just, well, I guess this is what I'm going to do. I didn't even realize I was an entrepreneur, quite honestly. I was just, well, just kind of, it's the next logical thing. So that's kind of how I got into it. Now, once I start, I obviously, there was a few guys that I worked with who were wildly successful that I definitely learned from, but this was way, way later. You know, this was probably 5 years later and then like 6-7 years later. So that's how it started. Yeah, no books, no mentors, just no options. Let's see. What do you think of Costa Rica as a place to live? A little overpriced. I mean, if you're going to go down that way, Taylor, I would much rather be in Colombia, in Medellin more specifically. I mean, Costa Rica, you got a certain type of buyer that's going to be there. But with Medellin, it's a super, I mean, it's like San Francisco, or it's like San Francisco or LA, or I mean, it's a proper city, a financial district. It's got all this where, you know, Costa Rica is great, but it's more people who want to kind of bug out, for lack of a better word. And I think it's a little overpriced, especially compared to Medellin. I don't know that you can get the same RV ratios. I'm wondering if you see any benefits. Costa Rica, no military. I don't know. That might be a benefit, but I just personally, I would prefer Colombia if you're going to go that route. All renewable. Yeah, but I hate to get caught up on the expat thing because I did that in Ecuador. I mean, you could say the exact same things about Ecuador. Although they have a military, but it's a joke. So I don't know if you can really count what they have as a military. But same thing, you know, push for renewable energy, super, super popular with expats and like international living. I think that's the website. Like Cuenca as an example. And I don't know. I mean, if you're going there for a lifestyle, fantastic. If you're going there to make money, I think there are places you could go where the risk reward is a lot better. What do I think about Ethereum? I think it's interesting. I've been focusing more of my energy on understanding Bitcoin and trying to think through that as a speculation. But I don't have a position in Ethereum. I think it's, like I said, I think it's interesting. I don't know if I've studied it well enough to give you a real value-packed opinion and idea. So I'll take a pass. I don't know if Lynn, now I was going to say, AJ, I would see if Lynn Alden has done any work on that, because you know if Lynn's done the work, then it's going to be, the research is going to be incredible. But I don't know that she has. I think that she's really focused her attention on Bitcoin as well. But I'd check her Twitter feed or check her website. her blog. I think it's LynnAlden.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
The last housing crash freshened investors' mind. Do you think that the next one will be much more rapid, 2 to 3 years, as opposed to 6 years? I don't. It could be. I mean, I totally get your argument, but honestly, I think it has to do more with interest rates. It's as crazy as that sounds. Because I'm under the opinion that one of the main reasons there's such short supply right now, other than the obvious that people don't want to sell and just everything that's going on in the crazy world in which we live, but also, I think so much of the inventory of starter homes, not across the United States, but in specific markets, which when you look at it as a percentage of how many possible homes could be available to new buyers, it's a significant percentage of these homes are owned by private equity funds. And especially, and these are the homes that you really see going up in price. You know, it's not really the high end, although the high end and the outskirts, I get it, it's going up in price because people are just trying to kind of get some freedom from the Cerveza sickness. But if you look at kind of the broad strokes, excuse me, the U.S. housing market from like a 30,000 foot level, the main price appreciation is kind of with these starter homes, right? The homes under like 300 grand in most markets. That's what's really gone ballistic. And so you say, why? Okay, supply. But see, that's where all these private equity funds have so much of their, or that's the inventory that so many of these private equity funds own. Okay, so what's the big deal? Private equity funds are not, they're not real estate guys usually. And I guarantee you that most of them are looking at their real estate investments saying, well, this sucks. This is a lot of hard work. It's a lot of maintenance. These property managers are ripping us off. And they're like, man, it's a lot easier to get a 6 or 7% return with just a treasury. And so I don't know when it happens, but I think one of the triggers for the housing market going down, kind of like a double whammy trigger, would be the interest rates going up. So mortgage rates go up, therefore housing becomes less affordable for new buyers. And therefore you have fewer buyers, price downward pressure on prices. But at the same time, you have potentially a lot of supply hitting the market because a lot of these private equity funds are looking at this, let's call it 6% return that they're getting with a lot of work for rents when they could just liquidate, take that money and then put it into a 10-year treasury and get 6 or 7%. You know, I think you're going to see them parlaying that capital. You're going to see them shifting their capital from real estate into something that they just know better, and that's stocks and bonds. The question is, when do we get to those rates, if ever? I don't know. But my point is, in order to get a super quick, like 2-3 year like 50% down in the housing market, I think you'd need to see much higher interest rates to have that rotation from the private equity firms and the hedge funds. And then one more thing I want to point out there that I think is important is so many people get super focused on housing affordability because the interest rates are low, therefore their mortgage payments are cheap. And I totally get it. And that argument makes sense all day long. But my pushback there is, okay, although higher interest rates might not affect the current owner of the property because they've got a fixed rate, if they ever want to sell, you know, what's going to happen is they're going to have to sell into a market where buyers have less disposable income or less money or less purchasing power because interest rates are higher, and therefore their mortgage payment on the property with the same exact value is going to be significantly higher. And that means fewer buyers or less purchasing power, less demand, therefore downward pressure in prices. One last thing, and I'm going to use this as a shameless plug to check out the new Rebel Capitalist channel. I did a deep dive on the forbearance for mortgages, and I looked into the CARES Act specifically. And I pull up the actual CARES Act when I'm looking at it and reviewing it. And I don't think anyone has thought this through. We all know the forbearance for mortgages is 180 days, and then you can extend it another 180 days, so about a year total. But no one asked the question, well, what was the deadline for applying for the forbearance in the first place? I think most people think that it was like 30 days after the CARES Act or like 90 days after the CARES Act. Nope. It's indefinite. It's indefinite. If you read the fine print with the CARES Act, and I do it in that video on Rebel Capitalist, you see that it's predicated upon when the United States declares they're no longer in a national emergency. So now I tried to find, are we in a national emergency? I know we declared it. I would assume that we still are because we're dealing with the Cerveza sickness. So when do they lift the national emergency title? Who knows? they could have it for the rest of 2021, in which case, according to the CARES Act, you, the homeowner, or the mortgage owner, let's say, you can still file for forbearance. So right now there's 5 million people roughly with mortgages that are under forbearance. And those 5 million people, unless we get another extension, which we very well could, you know, they're not paying their mortgage. That would be new supply that would come into the market, assuming that they can't sell, they can't make those payments. If unemployment stays structurally high, which if you look at jobless claims, I think it will, that could be a lot of additional supply coming under the market at that time. But you've got that cross current of more and more people or different groups of people that may be losing their jobs in the future, being able to actually file for the forbearance because there's just no deadline on it because of this this little clause that says that you're more than able to file an application and most likely will be approved so long as the United States is in a state of national emergency. So just kind of a quick little insider secret there that I wanted to reveal because I think it's very relevant if we're trying to think through and figure out the probabilities of the of home prices going down or up in 2021 and beyond. I have an investment property in Australia that has a positive yield. That's a tough question, Michael, because obviously you're in a massive property bubble down there. You got a positive yield. See, the thing is, though, you can't do the 30-year fixed. I don't know, man. I can't tell you what to do, but if it were me, I'd probably sell. because I have so many. See, that's the problem, though. I'm very unique in the sense that I've got a lot of other options that I could take that equity and put it into, where the risk reward is so much better. And I understand that if you're Australian and you know you got a family and everything, you just can't travel all around the world and just be like, oh my gosh, this country's amazing. Let me buy a property here. Let me put my equity to work here instead. I get it. I get that that's not realistic for most people. But I really would not want my equity in Australian property right now. It would be a little different, the thought process, if you had a 30-year fixed rate mortgage, but I'm almost 100% certain you do not. And those interest rates could adjust. And if they adjust, bam, all of a sudden you don't have a positive yield, you got a negative yield. And then you're really stuck holding the bag, because once interest rates or mortgage rates start going up there, you could have that whole bubble start collapsing to where you've got no bid on your property for months, potentially even years. And that's not a fun position to be in. So I can't tell you what to do, Michael, but I can just tell you what I would do. And I would be tempted to sell and take that equity and put it to use in another area, maybe not even in real estate, maybe in some of the commodity stocks that we talk about in Rebel Capitalist Pro. But just put it somewhere where the risk reward, I think, was more attractive. George, can you please provide your detail and go, go into some depth into changing your thinking about how debt is an asset and property is liability? It's not really changing my thinking. I'm trying to change your thinking. My thinking was changed quite some time ago. But basically, that was something that I addressed in my last video on real estate. I just did it Friday night. So if you guys want to check that out, it's been very, very popular. So you'd probably enjoy that whiteboard video if you want to try to figure out where prices are going for housing in 2021. But at the end of the video, I just try to pose the question, you know, is your property the actual asset on your balance sheet, or is it the liability? So what I mean by that is, in the past, like prior to all these housing bubbles, like let's say prior to 2000, you know, that no one would have even asked that question. When you buy a house, or let's say a rental property, the property is the asset. That's what you just bought. That's what throws off the cash flow. And then your mortgage on the property is the liability. That's your loan. That's what you owe the bank. But see, now in this crazy world in which we live, and with housing prices in so many areas being just in a huge, huge bubble, and if you're buying a property where the price is extremely high relative to the historic trend line adjusting for inflation, then I would argue that property is actually a liability, because you've got so much downside in the nominal price and the real price, by the way, of the house. Now, I'm not saying that nominal prices are going down. I think they most likely will kind of trend higher in 2021. I think it really depends on that forbearance. If the forbearance kicks in and people have to really start paying their mortgages again, and if we don't have any more stimmies, then I think you're going to see nominal prices start to head south. I don't know that we're going to see a 50% drop in 1 year, but I think they, toward the end of the year, they'd probably head south a little bit. But I think that, you know, you could just see nominal prices stay flat, nominal prices go up a little bit. But in real terms, I think when you look at what the value of your house is doing relative to goods and services, even in 2021, I think you're going to be losing purchasing power on it. And let's remember, why is it important to look at inflation adjusted prices? Because that's kind of, in a way, telling you what you can, how many loaves of bread you can buy with your house, right? So if right now you can buy 100,000 loaves of bread with your house, and next year you can only buy 90,000 loaves of bread with your house, but the price of your house has increased, are you richer or are you poorer? You're poorer because your purchasing power has actually decreased. So my point is, I think that if you look at a long-term chart, you've got to come to the conclusion that at some point in time, we've got to get back down to the historic trend line, because that's based on income, and income is what you need to pay the mortgage. So that historic trend line is, let's say, 50% below where it is today, but that doesn't mean that we go back down in nominal prices, right? It could happen just in real prices. But regardless, you see what I'm saying? Because we're so much higher than we have ever, not that we've ever, but than historic trend line going back to 2000, about 1998, which was about flat when you look at it going all the way back to 1900. So on our 100 and let's call it 30-year trend line, the prices are so much higher than that, adjusted for inflation. You've got a lot of downside. So that's why I say that the property could potentially, or in my opinion, is probably more of a liability right now than an asset. Now, why is the loan an asset? Because if you can get a fixed rate 30-year mortgage at 3% and you've got a property that's cash flow positive, it's paying you a good return to own it, you're being paid to short the dollar. To me, that's an asset. That's like a moneymaker, right? So it's like it's switched. Like now we went from thinking about the house in terms of increasing our purchasing power, but now I think you've got a higher probability of the loan itself increasing your purchasing power. And it might offset the decrease in purchasing power of the property itself. So how does that work? Okay, well, if you've got a 30-year fixed rate mortgage, meaning your mortgage payments will always be the same, any increase in the rate of inflation compared to the interest is a transfer of wealth from the lender to you, right? So let's take it to its extreme. So we're able to get our head around it here. So let's say you take out a loan today for $100,000 to buy a house. And let's just say you have a balloon payment. So in 10 years, you have a balloon payment. Well, let's just call it 150 grand because you got 50 grand in interest and you don't have to make a payment between now and then. I know, unrealistic, but we're just using it as an example to really understand the concept. And let's say that we go through a bout of hyperinflation. Okay. Well, today, let's say that you can buy 100 loaves of bread with that $100,000, or in other words, with your house. In 10 years, you can still most likely buy 100 loaves of bread or close to it. It's not going to be zero. Let's say 100,000 loaves of bread with the house. Okay. But let's say we have so much hyperinflation that a loaf of bread costs $100,000. See, so now you can make that balloon payment with a loaf and a half or two loaves of bread. Okay, but remember your house, you can buy 100,000 loaves of bread. See, so you've had a transfer of wealth from the bank to you of of 99,998 loaves of bread. That's purchasing power. So you see, that's why I think you could possibly make more money, if you want to use that term, on the loan or the 30-year fixed rate mortgage than you can on the actual property over the long term. Hopefully that, it's a little harder to explain without a whiteboard, but hopefully taking it to those extremes helps you understand the overall concept. Okay, we're over there, guys. So I just want to remind everyone a couple things. Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. That's the online investment forum where I talk about stuff like this all the time with my good friends, Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. $1 trial right now at georgegammon.com/pro. And if you want this type of content where I'm kind of going on and ranting and going off on tangents, but specifically pertaining to news, as close to real time as possible, then check out my new YouTube channel at just Rebel Capitalist. All right, and let me do some shout outs here. We've got, Zori GV. Good to see you, my friend. Chris, Ed Edson, Paul Busby, Raymond C. Alicia, Richard B. Happy, Glenn Gordon, Tominator 3, Mark Splice, Tim Chillingworth, Randy, Nicholas Michaelson, All Nighter Heater, RR, DD Crew, Mark Wiley, Dr. Paul, Plumbing Heater, Brian Carl, Jim Wolf, Tribune O'Plebs, Mirza Beg, Joe G's Craft Cannabis and Guides. Thanks for hanging out with me again, my friend. Dustin McKinnon, Oriole SJ, Mark Clifford, Dill, Mike Valencia. It's jumping all over me here. Pat P, Alex Z, Emilio, Emilio Mack. It reminds me of a Night at the Roxbury. Emilio. All right, guys. You have an awesome rest of your weekend, and I will see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.